You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 13th of November 2015 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One. I'm Andrew Muller. On today's show, the US claims to have killed Mohammed Emwazi, masked star of many of Islamic State's most infamous snuff movies, in a drone strike in Raqqa. Is targeting individuals a legitimate or indeed useful tactic? My guests Phil Clark and James Rogers will be here to discuss that and the day's other top stories, including Lebanon's government, such as it is, meets to discuss responses to yesterday's Islamic State suicide bombing in Beirut. Is it getting harder to keep Syria's civil war on the other side of the border? At least one opposition leader in Burundi wants the UN to send peacekeepers to his country to prevent violence, which is already bad, from getting worse. Are we about to see a test of the idea that we learnt anything from Rwanda? Finally, Russia reveals, accidentally or otherwise, plans for a nuclear doomsday torpedo. Do we believe the thing is feasible? Do we believe that the disclosure was an accident? Can we believe anything on Russian television? That's all coming up on Midori House with me, Andrew Muller, on Monocle 24. Right now. And welcome to the show. My guests today are Phil Clark, reader in comparative and international politics at SOAS, and James Rogers, senior lecturer in journalism at City University. Welcome both. Now, as we go to air, it is not altogether confirmed that Mohammed Emwazi, the Kuwaiti-born British Islamic State figure better known by the tabloid sobriquet Jihadi John, has been killed by a drone strike in the IS capital of Raqqa. The US military has so far said they have a high degree of certainty that their missile found its mark, but there is no doubt that Emwazi was the target. But is targeting a prominent individual symbolic or strategic, or indeed is the symbolism part of the strategy? James, I'll ask you first. They've been fairly upfront about the fact that Emwazi was the target, and he's not the first individual by any means that they have gone after. Does this really damage Islamic State, or is this just, or is this basically a way of generating a few congratulatory front pages?
I don't think it damages Islamic State probably in the long term, and it will certainly generate a few congratulatory front pages. One only had to pick up the London Evening newspaper on the way here to the studio this evening to see exactly that. But I think in some ways it sends a number of messages. Firstly, given that Islamic State has made its own media coverage such a very central part of its entire operation, then in that sense it is a propaganda blow has been struck. And as the British Prime Minister David Cameron said, it demonstrates that we, the Britain, has a long reach. I think some people might choose to question that, really, because I think in some ways, given that Jihadi John, Mohammed Emwazi, has been involved in so many of these horrific decapitations, had the government really such a long reach, they would presumably have got to him before he carried out as many as he did.
Well, one would have hoped so. Phil, is it at least arguable that, picking off this one individual at least does it could conceivably, you could argue, disrupt Islamic State's leadership, and one would hope has a somewhat sobering effect on potential recruits?
I mean, I think it might be a minor disruption to Islamic State, but it does seem that as soon as one individual gets eliminated, there are 12 waiting in the wings to sort of join the ranks. So I don't think it's going to have a huge impact in that regard. I thought what was perhaps just as telling as that the killing itself was the US and the UK's government reactions to it, this sort of bloodthirsty celebration of the fact that an individual's been killed. This idea that individuals make a massive difference within a large organization, I thought, was also interesting. And a US colonel referred to Emwazi as a human animal. And I thought this is ironic, given that IS is being described as barbaric and kind of a sort of anti-human. We're getting this kind of rhetoric out of the US government. So an enormous amount of hypocrisy, I would say.
James, you mentioned there earlier Islamic State's own media outreach and Mohammed Emwazi's role in that. Is there an argument that, and it is a difficult balance, I'm sure, for responsible news organisations to judge, but are any of them in any way culpable for actually encouraging him or encouraging Islamic State in general by basically acting as distributors of their snuff movies?
Well, I think one of the interesting things about Islamic State and their relation to modern technology is their very sophisticated understanding of it. And I think one of the reasons why, as a former foreign correspondent myself, I watch with great sadness the way that journalists have become deliberate targets in this sort of game, is that the fact is that organisations like Islamic State don't need news organisations as once they did. They can get to their audiences directly through the internet. They don't need, as Osama bin Laden did back in the day, to invite journalists in to be interviewed in the way that they once did. Nevertheless, I think that it is important that, you know, it strikes a blow against their supposedly sophisticated media machine, and it will show the limits of that.
You were talking there, Phil, about the somewhat bloodthirsty rhetoric which has greeted Mr. Remwazi's demise. Is it arguable, and you know, the argument has been raised by the leader of the opposition here, Jeremy Corbyn, who suggests that it would have been better if he'd appeared in a court of law, even leaving aside the logistical difficulties of that. This was an argument that was also made about bin Laden as well, of course. Should someone like Remwazi be regarded as merely a criminal and pursued in that manner, or by doing what he's chosen to do, is he in fact, you know, a legitimate target of war? He is a soldier in an enemy army.
I think this is another part of the hypocrisy, particularly from the UK government. It's a signatory of the International Criminal Court. It says that it sees the court as a key way of resolving conflicts around the world. The UK is very happy to preach the gospel of international law to a whole range of other states that are involved in ongoing conflict. And yet when it comes to its own conflict with its own combatants involved, it sees these kind of attacks on individuals and attempts to murder them as completely legitimate. It's perhaps a little more complicated with the US because they've never signed up to the ICC, and they seem much more agnostic about international law. But I think the UK in particular is on very thin ice with these kind of drone attacks and the idea that you can just eliminate criminal actors on the ground.
James, what do you think? Is someone, where on that spectrum from criminal to actual enemy combatant does Mohamed Remwazi or indeed any other Islamic State foot soldier exist?
That's a very good question. I think in some ways, international law such as it is, as Phil has rightly pointed out, this is a case which obviously ideally would have been brought to court, but completely impractical, and it was simply never going to happen. So, David Cameron has talked about this as being almost an act of defence, of having eliminated a threat. Clearly, if the videos which you've seen, if Mohamed Remwazi's role in them is such as it was portrayed, then he was guilty of murder, of multiple murder. But he would also probably have argued that he was a soldier in an army, but no war has been declared here. So in some ways, it's quite difficult to see where this lies in terms of international law, although, of course, that doesn't just permit people to go and to carry out drone strikes in the way that they've been carried out in very many different parts of the Middle East over the last few years.
Well, let's move on now to, the same story from a different angle, because that Islamic State is far more than one man, and with reach beyond the territory it holds was confirmed once again yesterday by twin suicide bombings in Beirut. It could actually have been worse. A third bomber was killed without detonating his explosives. The blasts killed at least 44 people in the predominantly Shia southern suburb of Burj al Barajneh, and this was clearly a strike at one remove against Hezbollah, the Lebanese Shia militia, which has fought alongside Syria's government in the war next door. Certainly an attempt to inflame eternally combustible Lebanon. The question is, will it work? James, what surprises me actually about Lebanon, which I know very slightly, though it's been a while since I was last there, is that question from the other angle. It seems actually kind of astonishing and indeed impressive that Lebanon has not been sucked entirely into Syria's war.
Yes, I think it has, given the great involvement, particularly of Syria in Lebanon in the period after the civil war. And I think that reading the news reports from there, you get a sense from the citizens of Beirut and around that there was a degree of relief and surprise that they hadn't yet been brought into this, which I think is why, if Islamic State are responsible for this bombing, it's going to be cause for a great deal of concern. But in terms of where Lebanon and Syria lie, I think, given, as you pointed out, Hezbollah's extensive involvement in the civil war in Syria, the borders in that part of the world, and particularly between Lebanon and Syria, have to a degree ceased to exist. So I suppose it's not that surprising that the war has crossed a border which it had already crossed in the opposite direction, if you like.
Phil, Lebanon's Prime Minister Tamam Salam has held an emergency cabinet meeting, although the question of the effectiveness of Lebanon's government is and coherence of Lebanon's government is, of course, an open one. They haven't actually been able to agree on a president now for 17 months. Is he facing the reality? And I think this is a reality they've... I mean, it puts me in mind of a telling incident I experienced myself in about 2002 when I was spending some time in southern Lebanon with Hezbollah, and every Lebanese military checkpoint we arrived at, the road was blocked by the soldiers until they understood who was in the vehicle, at which point the soldiers stepped aside and waved the Hezbollah cars respectfully through. Is the reality that basically Hezbollah is just going to do what it's going to do, and there's not really an awful lot whoever claims to be Lebanon's government can do about it?
It does seem that way. It seems that Hezbollah operates in a complete political and military vacuum. As you say, the Lebanese government is extremely fragile. And the Lebanese government seems entirely exercised with this issue of dealing with the refugee population that's come across the border from Syria.
Refugee population, which is now about a third of Lebanon's population.
Indeed. And per capita, Lebanon by far is the greatest recipient of Syrian refugees. So this comes at a time when the government is already under massive pressure, and it seems to have created at least a little bit of domestic popular opposition to the refugee population. People are suffering because of the pressure that the refugees are putting on the Lebanese economy. So the government's fragile in that sense, and I think a group like Hezbollah sees that and realizes the Lebanese state will be no serious opposition to it. I think the other part of this story, of course, is that it highlights just how much that the war in Syria is about larger powers in the region. And in many ways, you could see this as a proxy war, particularly pitting Iran against Saudi Arabia. We often talk about it in terms of IS and very discreet kind of military actors on the ground, but clearly there are bigger powers in the background pulling strings here, which complicates any kind of effort to resolve this conflict without very serious international diplomacy, which would also require the US to rein in Saudi Arabia, which is something that the US has basically never wanted to do and certainly hasn't in the last 10 or 12 years.
James, is it possible, do you think, and this is just a vague pet theory of mine, I'm not sure how much there is to it, that Lebanon, the fact that Lebanon itself and so many Lebanese people have quite recent memories of a hideous multi-sided sectarian civil war, the one that went between 75 and 90, that memory is kind of insulating them to an extent from getting involved in another one?
Well, I think it probably is to some extent, but I mean, you mentioned the dates there, 75 to 90. Now, we are talking really about a generation ago. And of course, the other thing is that many of the motives for conflict, and particularly in that region, come from history and often can reignite when a new generation comes on along, motivated perhaps by history, but without that direct experience of the actual bloodshed. So, and I think given the state of the entire region, I mean, Phil was talking about, you know, it being seen sometimes as a proxy war. There was almost a sense of optimism in some quarters when Russia first got involved in Syria, that this might somehow be the beginning of a process whereby Russia and the United States could cooperate and try to launch a political process. We've heard a few initiatives launched there, but we haven't seen any concrete progress. And we've also seen plenty of bad blood exchange between the United States and Moscow too. So not necessarily a cause for optimism there either, I don't think.
Phil, on that subject of motivations, I was struck by Islamic State's statement in the wake of the bombings, or at least the statement attributed to Islamic State. It's everybody's best guesses and assumptions that this is actually them explaining themselves. They made no reference whatsoever to Hezbollah's involvement in Syria, no reference whatsoever to the fact that they are more or less at war with Hezbollah. Instead, it was a lot of fairly nakedly sectarian blathering about the righteousness of apostates, as they called the victims of this bombing. I just wonder sometimes if looking at the Middle East from a Western point of view, especially, if we underestimate the animating factor of just plain old straightforward religious hatred.
I do think so. I think with Islamic State in particular, I think that's a really key underpinning of the whole movement, is this kind of old clash between Shia and Sunni sort of subsets of Islam, if you like. And I think that when we look at the sort of structure of IS attacks over the last couple of years, that they've been almost indiscriminate in terms of which specific ethnic or linguistic populations and which rebel groups and governments they've targeted. The thing that holds all of that together is a very particular idea of Islam and a very particular idea of who's right historically in terms of interpretations of Islamic law. So I think that does fit into this kind of statement we've seen in Beirut overnight. It seems very consistent.
James, we also saw, again, another intriguing statement, this one from Hezbollah, who promised, as they put it, to step up their war against satanic terrorists, which does rather make you wonder how far through the looking glass we have actually proceeded. Is it possible that, and again, this, my own recollections of the time I spent with them are somewhat out of date because this is going back 12 or 13 years, but what struck me up close, at least talking to them, especially off the record, was that they at no level at all came across as a bunch of ranting, incoherent fanatics. They were extremely smart, extremely serious people with, you know, aims and ambitions which I didn't agree with myself, but there was a coherence to it. You could actually see that there is an intellectual underpinning here. That I hesitate to use the word reasonable, but I think you know what I'm saying. Yes. Is it possible that they could actually end up being part of a solution?
I think they're going to have to be. I mean, as far given the force which they are in the region, I mean, governments can talk as much as they like about not wanting to talk to terrorists, and yet history is full of examples where governments have had to do just that in order to reach a solution. And it was something which was long maintained. In, for example, if we're thinking about the British conflict in Northern Ireland, that was resolved through talking in the end to terrorists. The same will be true of any long-term settlement which emerges in Afghanistan as well. But the government there and its Western backers are going to have to engage directly with groups whom they readily identify as terrorists. And the same, given Hezbollah's strength in Lebanon, but also, of course, as we've been saying, their role in Syria, it's inconceivable to think of any wider settlement without their engagement.
Okay, well, we're going to take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House here with me, Andrew Muller, along with Phil Clark and James Rogers. Coming up next, are political tensions in Burundi in danger of pushing the country into or towards ethnic genocide? We'll be talking about that and more besides.
The Monocle Minute is a just-launched daily email bulletin covering all the topics we're passionate about, from global affairs to retail news, finance to urbanism, architecture to transport. Packed with opinion and reports from around the globe, it's a unique briefing on the day from our editors and correspondents. Go to monocle.com to sign up for free today, and we'll send you the Monocle Minute to your inbox every weekday and deliver you a special cultural roundup at the weekends too. Monocle, keeping an eye and an ear on the world every day of the week.
Join Monocle 24's international editors and correspondents as they touch down in a different city each week for our brilliant new travel program. Come on board for a one-stop audio guide to the most dynamic emerging cities around the world. As well as hospitality highlights and key cultural hotspots, we'll also visit new retail spaces, sample the local food scene, and meet the design denizens that a potentially time-poor traveller can ill afford to miss. The Voyager, in association with Turkish Airlines, is now boarding.
And welcome back to Midori House on Monocle 24. Still with me are Phil Clark and James Rogers. Now, for 21 years, the international community has agonised over whether more could or should have been done to intervene in Rwanda in 1994, whether essentially a rapid deployment of well-armed professional soldiers might have had a useful deterrent effect on ragbag militias equipped with machetes. At least one voice in neighbouring Burundi, a country with a comparable history of ethnic mayhem, has asked for the lesson to be heeded amid escalating violence. One opposition leader has asked the UN to send peacekeepers. Phil, is that a reasonable request at this point? Are things that bad?
Yeah, things are really bad in Burundi. But I think what's even more terrible is that it's been bad for 7 or 8 months. And there's no sign, really, that the violence has escalated in the last couple of weeks. The thing that's changed is the rhetoric coming from Nkurunziza's government. And the rhetoric I think, reminds a lot of people of the kinds of things that were said in Rwanda in 1994. There's the kind of defining of the enemy in terms of cockroaches and animals who are supposed to be eliminated. There's talk of militias being sent to work. This is the kind of language that many of the militias in Rwanda used in the lead up to the genocide in 94. And I think that's the thing that has the Burundian opposition and a lot of actors on the ground very worried. But I mean, I sat here on a Monocle program at the end of November, beginning of December last year, and I was asked, you know, what is the case in 2015 of conflict that we should be keeping an eye on? And I said, Burundi, Burundi, Burundi. This has been no secret to anyone who works on this region that Burundi was ready to blow. And so it's incredible to me that we've got till November 2015 and there's call for serious international intervention. The signs were already there at least a year ago that this situation could go extremely, extremely badly.
We did speak about this a few months back, I think, shortly after Pierre Nkurunziza had extended his presidency in debatable circumstances. And you said what was interesting so far, that while the violence was obviously bad, it appeared to be explicitly political in nature, that it was people on different sides of the argument arguing over an idea, that it had not become ethnically defined. Are there concerns that that's beginning to change?
Yeah, I've always been a little bit worried by this idea that we should be placated by the fact that it's only been political violence. And I think there are kind of two problems with that. One is the political violence itself has been absolutely horrendous. So there's no significant difference between political and ethnic violence when it actually targets civilians. But I think the bigger problem, and this is maybe what we are seeing in the last couple of weeks, is that I've always believed there was an ethnic underpinning to some of this conflict. That it may not have been the dominant factor in Burundian politics over the last 10 years, and that's quite remarkable in and of itself. But it's not as though the divisions between Hutu and Tutsi have gone away. And there are constituencies in Burundi that can be mobilized around those ethnic identities. So the kind of rhetoric that we've been hearing from the Burundian government in the last couple of weeks has started to tap into that ethnic component, and that could add something to this violence that thus far we haven't really seen.
James, it's become an article of faith that the world was in gross dereliction and error in 1994 in not sending troops, that there were warning signs that people asked for troops to be sent. This is all known. This is documented. Bill Clinton, who was president at the time, subsequently apologized for the West's abandonment of Rwanda to its fate. 21 years later, if things in Burundi are or could be that bad, is it any likelier that, you know, if not necessarily the UN, that the Western world in particular might actually be willing to step up?
I think it's probably a case that's very difficult to make, unfortunately. And I think one sees, I mean, you know, Phil has outlined the fact that this has been, for people who keep a close eye on this region, this has been coming from some way off. But I think we see there's probably a great absence of political will. I mean, the fact is that international diplomatic and military resources, such as they are, have their focus elsewhere. They have their focus principally in some of the regions about which we've been talking earlier this evening. And I think possibly, unless and until there is a huge explosion there, we're unlikely to see any sort of deployment. And even if such a huge explosion does happen, there's going to be a question of who actually has the desire or the wherewithal to commit troops. I think it's very, very worrying to hear some of the things which Phil has been saying about the demonisation which has been happening through the media. One is reminded, of course, of the infamous case of Radio Mille Collines, which was so, and still now is really an infamous case in one of my subject areas, journalism and media studies, precisely for the role which it is said to have played in the genocide in 1994.
Just a final thought on this one from you, Phil. And I think it is always the question that does, or at least should, hang over situations like this. From, you could say, the West's point of view, the UN's point of view, the wider world's point of view, what happens if we do nothing?
I think Burundi goes into a pretty drastic slide over the next 5 or 6 months. I think everything at the moment is being prepared for massacres on a drastic scale. We've got training of militias that are very heavily armed, an almost complete destruction of domestic media. So there's very little reporting of the violence internally and very little accountability, and this ramping up of rhetoric by politicians, and also complete inaction, not only by international leaders, but also by African leaders in the region. And so the message that sends to Nkurunziza is you can do what you like inside your borders, and no one really has any interest in intervening.
Okay, well, that's a story we shall doubtless return to in future programs. But finally tonight, regular viewers of Russian state television will be well aware that it provides a reliably entertaining view of a weird parallel universe in which John Pilger is somehow right about everything. Even by those standards, however, one recent broadcast on state-run Channel 1 was rather an eyebrow archer. A report on Vladimir Putin meeting his military chiefs showed one of the top brass regarding plans for a long-range nuclear torpedo. The Kremlin has since insisted that this was shown, and I quote, in error. James, are they just having a lark? This is this thought that occasionally occurs to me, that they've just sat around, they've thought, no one's paid any attention to us for at least 48 hours. Why don't we accidentally, in inverted commas, broadcast plans for some submarine doomsday device and watch everyone go nuts?
Yes, because one would imagine that Mr. Putin himself, a former KGB officer, and not many of the people around the table, obviously military officers, would not be minded to let this happen accidentally, as appears to have been the case, and something which Mr. Putin's spokesman, a version of events which Mr. Putin's spokesman has been very ready to confirm. However, of course, as with so many of these Russian things, it's got two audiences. It's got an audience domestically which are going to say, look at our fantastic new weapons. And it's very interesting that in his remarks, Mr. Putin says, we're not entering an arms race. We're just trying to catch up with the 1990s and the 2000s, that chaotic post-Soviet period which allowed Mr. Putin to build his rise to power. But of course, too, there's speculation. One can imagine, even if this is being treated something as a little bit of a joke, how accidental was this? I'm going to imagine that there are intelligence agents in the West who are having a pretty close look at those few seconds which were broadcast.
I mean, you obviously, as an experienced journalist and a professor of journalism, you would be well aware of the technique, the deniable leak, because even if you have weapons or indeed just plans for weapons, there's no point unless your potential enemies know you've got them.
Yes, exactly. I mean, I think, and this is why it's so sort of, the whole thing does seem, given by this pretty sophisticated standards of Russia's modern media techniques, it does seem a little clumsy, particularly with the spokesman saying, oh, this was a terrible mistake. I think obviously leading many of us to conclude that it's probably anything but.
Phil, the weapon in question, Ocean Multipurpose System Status 6, They've got to come up with something better than that. That is poor. It does need a splashier name. If it was brought into being, it's an impressive device. The idea, as I understand it, it is a submarine nuclear torpedo you can launch at the cities of your enemies on their coasts, which will create an enormous tsunami which will destroy everything for 100 miles around and douse everything in cobalt radiation. What would be Russia's interest in suggesting to the world that they either have one of these things or they're thinking about building them?
It seems very consistent with Russia's military activities over the last year or so, many of which seem to be about telling the world we're still here. Don't ever think that we've gone away. We're capable of playing with the big boys. We can throw our might around. We can get involved in places like Syria. And look, we're also regaining our position in the arms race. The other thing that it strikes me is that it makes the British debate about Trident seem quite arcane and very old-fashioned. And my fear is that the British may now feel that they're also falling behind in the nuclear weapons race, and so we may also have to see these kind of fancy pictures of submarines in the British press too, a particular British obsession with Trident at the moment.
James, you know, again, referring to your bailiwick as a professor of journalism, how important to Russia generally has been their media strategy? They're kind of quite deliberate, quite careful creation of a malleable reality, if you will.
It's been massively important. I think if you go back to the last decade, when the Kremlin first hired Western public relations agencies to try to help them to improve their media coverage or the way that they were seen in the West, they've gone through a very sophisticated transition since then. One of the stages was their war with Georgia in 2008, which was really to a very large extent partly because of the then Georgian president Mikhail Saakashvili fought along the airways of international news channels. And since then, Russia has decided they don't necessarily want to play the Western game. They're going to start their own, and that's, they've pumped massive resources which would make millions of dollars, which would make any Western news organization green with envy these days. They have put into Russia Today, into their Sputnik news agency. And it is a very, very important part. We've seen, in some ways, conscious aping of some of the news footage which was released by the United States during its wars in Iraq. conscious copying of that to portray some of the Russian military operations in Syria. So the message there is very much, not only are we of an important military player, but we've got the media arm to back it up and show you that too.
We will have to leave it there, unfortunately. James Rogers and Phil Clark, thank you both very much for joining us. That is all we have time for on today's episode of Midori House. It was produced by Tom Hall, researched by Bill Lutie, Clara Strunk and Aidan McLaughlin. Our studio manager was Toby Hammond. For the next half hour, Matt Alagaya is here keeping a company with Monocle's international playlist. Marcus Hippie follows him with a menu at 1900. At 2200, Emma Nelson and Peter Cardwell will bring you the Monocle Daily. Midori House returns at the same time on Monday. That's 1800 London time. But for this edition, it's goodbye. Thanks for listening. Have a good weekend.